From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from Eskenazi Health. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. On today's show, we go behind the scenes with video game designers, plie and releve with City Ballet's Evening with the Stars, and meet a visual artist who designs with guns. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. For fans of dance, one of the year's highlights is Indianapolis City Ballet's star-studded event, Evening with the Stars. We'll step up to the bar to learn more in a bit, but first, have you ever considered how video games are created? Contributor Pete Brown wondered and went on a mission. Oh, wait, that actually sounds like the name of a video game.
Well, my family is comprised of three generations of video gamers, and I think that's probably becoming more and more common, if not four generations out there. But I remember distinctly one time completing a game and watching the credits scroll and sitting there like I was at a movie, you know, and it really hit me at that point what an army it takes to make a video game title, especially nowadays. I've got three gentlemen with me this morning that are Hoosiers that are deeply involved in this, and I want to start off with a question for each of you, which is, what game, thinking back 15, 20 years, was the first one that really dug its nails in you and really inspired you to obsess and decide that you wanted to work in this industry growing up? Tom, let's start with you.
Yeah, for me, I believe it was a game called Ultima 2. And this was would have been about 1982 on the Atari 8-bit computer system. Mm-hmm. And I was a sixth grade, I believe, and it just captured me. I was obsessed with it, and from that day on, I knew that's what I wanted to do, was design video games.
Jake, how about you?
That's a tough one, because I think there are a lot of really great games that I've played over the course of my childhood, but the one that was decisive for me, I would probably have to say, is The Legend of Zelda, The Wind Waker. The open world and the exploration elements were really cool, and the story was great.
Chris?
Yeah. Well, since you said the first, I'd have to say Castlevania on the Nintendo was definitely the first one that really, using the term, sunk its teeth in me. The horror theme, it was the first game, I think, that kind of was more of an adult focus, like horror theme, and that really stuck with me. And the music, I remember just being so incredible in that game. And yeah, just really, from the box art to the graphics in the game to the music, it was a total package for me.
Yeah. So Tom is the founder of Basilisk Games and kind of the sole creator of the Echelon series of games. I know you wear a lot of hats.
That's right.
Where do you start with all of that? And talk a little bit about what the process has been like for you.
Yeah, it's a huge process, as you can imagine. And for me, it started with an idea. I think the initial concept for Echelon goes back to the 90s when I would develop pen and paper role-playing games, like classic Dungeons & Dragons modules. And when I had the opportunity to start Basilisk Games when I was in between jobs, I took those ideas, took those papers out, and I began creating a framework for the game, building the engine, building the game mechanics and the rule set, and building that up to the point where it was a playable demo of, you know, the first maybe 30 minutes of the game, and getting the screenshots out. And then, you know, it really began building a community around that. People would see the screenshots off of different websites and contact me and say, hey, I want to help out. You know, do you need help with music or graphics or writing, programming? But yeah, I did probably 80% of the game myself, except for the music was contracted out. And yeah, I mean, the rest is kind of history. It was 3 years of just working night and day, 7 days a week.
Chris, how about your experiences with your team on Sky Cursor and coming up with that story?
Well, it just started with a very sincere love of arcade gaming. You know, we knew right from the jump that we wanted to make an arcade exclusive game because, you know, not a lot of people are even considering that as a channel to develop on. And that required us to develop hardware and software. As the creative director on the team, I'm really responsible for the everything on the creative side, the art, kind of the core gameplay mechanics, and the music as well. But it was really one of those things that when you're passionate about it, it kind of helps spur that activity along. And even when it's hard and, you know, the money isn't, you know, right there around the corner, it's enough to motivate you to get things going.
I want to play a couple of pieces composed by one of our guests, Jake Harley. I want to play a piece that is very reminiscent of kind of an old school game and transition into something that has a little more of a modern feel. Traditionally, I think growing up and coming up through video games, there's always a lot of talk about the graphics. You know, it's going from Nintendo to Genesis to Nintendo 64, and there's kind of this, it's 8-bit, it's 16-bit, it's 64, and it just keeps getting more and more complex. But I think what's often overlooked is the concept of the audio that goes along with the video. Can you talk a bit, Jake, about how the role of sound effects and musical scoring have changed and how you feel that those evolutions have really impacted gaming and a player's experience?
First off, I think we've definitely seen audio in games move from something that may sound, I don't want to use the word cheap, but there were really small RAM budgets and you just didn't have a whole lot of room to fit sound in games earlier on. So it's moved from something like that earlier example that you played to cinematic full orchestras, really high quality audio and sound effects. There are not as many limitations now, so you can make it sound like a movie, honestly, versus something that just has some bleeps and bloops, which are great in their own way and when paired with the right aesthetic. But I just think it's evolved from a lot of synthesis to a lot of organic sounds being captured, and it's been really good for composers and sound designers because we don't have the hardware limitations that we used to. Maybe someone else.
If I could jump in, I see a trend though that there's a lot of games that are going back to that retro sound,
absolutely.
That 8-bit sound, that Nintendo sound, and even you know classic sound effects that are just generated via sine waves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool because I think it spans the whole gamut of creativity from. Like what Jake said, with a full orchestra to, you know, going back retro and bringing up those nostalgic feelings and that you hear in games like Zelda on the Nintendo or Mario.
And a lot of people are mixing and matching now, too, mm-hmm. which is really great because you get this fusion of really high-quality epic sounds that are mixed with this nostalgic, you know, a little bit of that flair, and you can get really cool results with that.
Real quickly, where can we go to experience more of what you all have going on right now?
BasiliskGames.com is my website, and from there you can go to Facebook or Twitter. We update that with anytime we have news to share with our fans, and you can keep on top of what we're working on.
Jake?
All right, for me, you can check out SoundCloud.com/Jake-Harley. You can also check out www.creechthegame.com if you're interested in Creech. Bushido can be found on IndieDB.
Yep. Chris?
Just search skycursor.com. We have all the social media profiles, and we also have, obviously, the homepage skycursor.com. But, yeah, if you run a search for Skycursor, we're the only thing that pops up, basically. So.
Nice. That's good.
Contributor Pete Brown with independent video game creators Thomas Riegsecker, Jacob Harley, and Christopher Cruz. For more information about their work and upcoming projects, visit basiliskgames.com. That's BASILISK games.com, skycursor.com, and soundcloud.com/Jake-Harley, spelled like the motorcycle. Both classical dance and cutting-edge contemporary choreography are on the menu as Indianapolis City Ballet presents its annual Evening with the Stars on Saturday, November 12th at the Murat Theater at Old National Center. The cabaret's Shannon Forsell warmed up with Kevin Hess to discover the details.
So it's time again for one of, I think, the most exciting events in the arts scene that happens annually, and that's Evening with the Stars. And it's taking place this Saturday, November 12th, and it's a gala-style performance that spotlights the best of the best in the world from ballet dancers and dance companies performing their signature works all on the same stage in the same evening. And what I think is amazing about it is you would have to travel all over the world to see all these folks, which no one can do. And so in Indianapolis, on one night, you can see all these folks right here. And so, Kevin, tell me more about this event and all of the great stuff coming up associated with it.
Thank you, Shannon. It'll be our eighth year this year of presenting the Evening with the Stars. That's what we call it. And we're very excited. It's almost an easy event to put on because we literally go and find the greatest dancers in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And put them on stage. I think one of the more interesting things, you do have to travel the whole world in order to find this kind of gala. There still isn't quite this. We spend mm-hmm. a lot of time curating contemporary works. I mean, literally half of our audience loves classical ballet, and the other half really doesn't, really likes contemporary ballet.
That's what I think is so cool about it.
You don't have to be
ballet to think this event is one of the most amazing things you've ever seen.
And with a lot of, you know, pieces that are 5 to 8 minutes each, I mean, you really, the program moves very quickly. It's entertaining for everybody. And as I always say, if you don't like one of the pieces, it'll be over in 5 minutes.
That's right.
But we're trying to track what's the future of ballet and really show you, you know, again, the greatest dancers doing what's new, what has not been seen anywhere else except maybe in the one home city where it was originally performed. So we'll have dancers from Berlin, from Stuttgart, from New York, New York City Ballet and ABT, from San Francisco Ballet and beyond.
Wow. And it is really an exciting event. And you've added some new elements to the event this year by adding an after party with the stars.
It's such a wonderful performance, and at the end, everybody starts gathering in the lobby and talking about it and seem to be almost dragging themselves away from the conversation that this performance sort of elicits. And so we're trying to make a bigger and bigger after party. We rented the Egyptian Room, which is gigantic, upstairs at the Murat Theater, and we're going to try and grow that into a really big live music, good food, drink, and almost a dance with the dancers kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The artists will all be there, and they always love to meet the audience members. So it's hopefully a really fun event, and it's a chance for the audience to meet, you know, again, some of the greatest dancers in the world.
You know, I think this is a question that a lot of folks ask. Why ballet in Indianapolis? You know, it's not worked out before, but obviously, you have visions that are beyond this annual event. And what are some of those? And tell us about what's in store in your dreams for ballet in Indianapolis.
Literally, ballet has worked in Indianapolis. I mean, you go back to 1920s, 1910, 1920, Ballet
right.
Russe came here twice a year. They would cross the country and they would spend a week here in Indianapolis at the Old English Theater and at the Murat Theater.
Right.
American Ballet Theater used to come through. For 40 years, there was a local company here.
And I think maybe that's what I was meaning. There wasn't a local company.
I mean, it has worked. It's very difficult because it's hard to talk about ballet. It's
right.
hard to get people to talk about ballet. If you see it, it's such an accessible art form. So, again, this sort of a program, this sort of performance, which is just so fast moving and high energy, it's sports meets arts, really.
It really is.
These are artists who are actually, you know, very, very strong athletes. And so it makes it very accessible. And I think it really feeds in the people who come to our performance, even if they don't like ballet, by the time they leave, they do.
That's exactly right, because I was one of those people.
Yeah.
You know, I think ballet has an old school, intimidating kind of folks struggle with it, like maybe some folks struggle mm-hmm. with opera, so mm-hmm. to speak. But that doesn't mean ballet is stuck in this continuum of time. Mm-hmm. It has evolved just like other
and
art
it moves
forms
forward.
Evolved.
I mean, yeah, first of all, the dancers are so much more physical than they have been. Every year, they keep upping the bar and that sort of thing. And contemporary work, it's really very it's exciting, I think, to look at. And it resonates with a crowd that would never have thought that dance or ballet
There were a ton of young people in the audience when I went, and they were just going crazy.
They're the screamers. They're the ones
right.
who are yelling and screaming and on their feet after each
piece. Which is also what you don't expect at a ballet.
No,
right?
So don't.
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, and that's another reason why the young folks are getting involved, because there's a whole educational element to all of this, too. Tell us a little bit about your master classes.
There is. We do a master class series. It's about once a month. I mean, there are 65 dance schools in Indianapolis, so we're just trying to – I mean, we promised everybody we wouldn't start a school. What we want to do is add value to what's already in the community here. And so we bring the directors of major schools, major academies around the world, and again, stars from the ballet world, and have them do these hour-and-a-half master classes and a Q&A. We film the Q&A, and it goes online on our website and on Vimeo. And we have more than 225,000 watches on that.
That's amazing.
So far. So there's
dancers,
an audience.
Yeah. So the dancers can go onto your site at IndianapolisCityBallet.org and watch these masterclasses on your site.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an absolutely fantastic element. Well, so this all culminates, obviously, in what we've been talking about, and that is Evening with the Stars, which is coming right up. It's a hot ticket. Get your ticket as soon as you can. It's for Saturday, November 12th. And you can buy the patron tickets, which are the tickets with the party, with all of the performers afterwards. You can purchase those tickets on IndianapolisCityBallet.org. Mm-hmm. And you can purchase tickets for the event itself by calling the Murat Theater at Old National Center box office at 1-800-745-3000 or visiting www.livenation.com. And, of course, it is taking place at the Murat Theater at Old National.
An early start time, too, at 6:30 this year.
6:30? So, yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. So plenty of time for the party afterwards.
We got party time afterwards, yes.
That's great. Well, get your tickets today, and thanks so much for talking to us, Kevin, and we look forward to a fantastic event for you.
Thanks so much, Anna.
Indianapolis City Ballet's Evening with the Stars pirouettes into the Murat Theater at Old National Center on Saturday, November 12th. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, urban sociologist Matthew Desmond explores equality and Ensemble Voltaire explores Indiana's early music. But first, it's time for Eat, Drink, Indy. This week, Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen. He just attended a James Beard Foundation food conference.
So, Ryan, I would love to hear about your experience with the James Beard Boot Camp for Policy and Change that I believe was this past spring, right?
Sure. Yeah, I attended a conference in western Montana with about 15 other chefs, and the James Beard Foundation hosts these boot camps across the country and kind of bring chefs together, and they talk about each boot camp is around a single issue, and the issue that I was there for was food waste. And the conference basically started off with the stat that 40% of the food that's produced in this country is wasted. And you think that, like, maybe it's transportation, maybe it's from the farm to the grocery store to the restaurant, like things are lost or spoiled along the way, and that like represents just a minuscule amount of the waste. When in reality, the waste really occurs in homes and in restaurants.
What we throw away.
What we throw away. There isn't a set way or a regulated way countrywide of dating food.
Sure.
So, like in the state of Montana, milk has to be thrown away after 14 days, even though pasteurized milk can last up to like 26 or 28 days.
Oh, my goodness. So right there is a huge amount of waste.
Yes. And a lot of these things, it's so common sense that if you change like the dating on something or if you allowed things to be donated, like there's laws against donating that milk to a food shelf where it would make a huge difference if
they just could.
Yeah.
Right. So now how did the bringing up these topics impact you as a chef? So, you had some time to process that. What was the result of that boot camp for you?
Well, I think when you're confronted with a statistic like that that's so large that it's shameful, and it is an inspiration to act and to like find out what else is out there. And immediately, you know, we looked at like what we did at the restaurant. We looked at our portion size. I'm known for putting a lot of food on the plate. Like, am I putting too much food on the plate? Are people finishing their entrees?
Well, now that's a question to ask, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. So that's the first place I looked, was just at the restaurant. And then obviously at our home too. Like, do we need to make so much?
Right. And you know, I'm terrible about, you know, buying things and then they get stuffed away in a crisper drawer where they don't get crisp. They just get squishy and then they get thrown away, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I guess just seeing that statistic of 40%, and then when you look at like how many people in this country are actually hungry, and like I'm also a little bit ashamed that I didn't know like the extent that, I mean, I realize that hunger exists and that, you know, people struggle, but there's 40 million people in this country that are food insecure.
Again, a shameful statistic.
We're the richest country in the history of the world. It's not that we don't have the product. It's not that we don't have it. We just lack the, you know, political will to change things. And, you know, I'm willing to do, you know, I don't know, whatever I can in my small part of this to hopefully, you know, change that.
Well, you know, we might not see hunger, you know, right in front of us all the time, you know, you know, living in Marion County or Hamilton County, but it's there, right?
Yeah, definitely. When I got back, I looked up some numbers, and yeah, I live in Fishers, and I looked up Hamilton County stats, and there's 28,000 people that in the richest county in Indiana that are food insecure, and 14% of those 28,000 are children.
Oh.
And it's just mind-boggling that like so many, you know, struggle with that. And it is hidden. It is something you don't think about. You know it exists. But when you see those numbers, and nationally it's 40 million people that are food insecure, and we have the food, we have the means, you know, we just need the political will to change how things, you know, work in this country to, you know, feed our own people.
Jolene Kentzenberger with Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen. Hear Jolene's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. In this year of all things bicentennial, have you thought about what music our forebears were listening to 2 centuries ago? Ensemble Voltaire has, and they've programmed a concert called When Indiana Was Young. It features works by Bach and Rameau, as well as some tunes you might have sung at a tavern for good measure. Bassist Chantal Incandela chatted with Ensemble Voltaire members violinist Allison Nyquist and harpsichordist Tom Gerber.
Tom, Allison, why early music? Well, for you, what is it about it? And I'll start with you, Allison.
Well, okay. Well, I was a modern violinist all the way through school. I was introduced to the Baroque violin in Tallahassee, Florida, when I was working on a doctorate at Florida State. But it was later that a friend came to me with a Baroque violin and said, "Learn this. I want to have a group with you." That I fell in love with it and found out that it was a very intimate way to make music. Small groups. I always felt like my voice really counted. I found that type of phrasing and music making came naturally to me, and I just never looked back. How about you, Tom?
Well, kind of the same thing. I started life as a pianist, like many harpsichordists do, and as an undergraduate at Little Hillsdale College up in Michigan, I was poking around behind stage one day in the hall, and there was a pile of music, and I started looking through the music and realized there was a funny table beneath the music. And the table turned out to be a harpsichord, the first harpsichord I'd ever seen, and I just started playing for fun and eventually started studying. And I, too, enjoy the chamber music and orchestral aspects of playing with my colleagues, and also enjoy solo playing at some of the places I teach.
So you are involved in a concert coming up celebrating Indiana's 200th birthday, when Indiana was young. And when you're putting together these programs with Ensemble Voltaire, it's normally a smaller, there's only for this program, I think there's 4 or 5 of you. When you're putting together a program, is it a collaborative thing between all of you? Who comes up with these ideas?
Well, the governing idea for the program is mine, because it's something that I've done as a solo harpsichordist as well. It's called When Indiana Was Young. And we look at music from basically the Baroque era, which happened to coincide with the colonial era here in the United States. But as far as the actual pieces on this program, we're all working together to come up with ideas. And so we'll have a mix of some Baroque standard composers like Bach and Rameau, and then a couple Baroque composers that aren't quite so standard like Leclerc and Marais, both a couple of French composers. And then we'll even do some pieces from popular tunes of the day, either here in the United States, or I think we're doing some Scots tunes as well.
Yes. When someone comes to your November concert when Indiana was young, let's say it's their first early music concert, obviously it's going to be different than their average Friday night at, you know, a classical concert, smaller, more intimate. What are some things that you think that they're going to hopefully notice, or what, and also what do you hope to show an audience, especially if one might, who might be new to an early music concert?
I would say that the research Tom has done and the readings that he has reflect really well on the music that we play from the different nationalities that influenced Indiana. So French music, for instance, can be hard to understand, but with a little bit of text, that it helps a lot. And I would say that people need to take their ears and kind of make them small, because we're quiet. We're a quieter group. And it takes a few minutes maybe to adjust to that. Mm-hmm. But people really enjoy being close to us and feeling very involved in what we do. It's a very intimate experience.
Agreed.
Tom?
I think what people will encounter if the first concert of early music they attend is the When Indiana Was Young concert, is that it's only partly a concert. There'll be plenty of music, but it'll be all connected by the spoken word. Not readings from books, but sort of paraphrases of what I've been researching. And, of course, there are jokes.
Bassist Chantal Incandela with Allison Nyquist and Tom Gerber, members of Indianapolis's Ensemble Voltaire. Their concert, When Indiana Was Young, is Sunday afternoon, November 20th at 4 o'clock at Indiana Landmark Center. Learn more at indiebaroque.org, indiebaroque.org. A sculptor, an activist, a professor, and a MacArthur genius walk into the Indiana Landmark Center to talk about the essence of home. Don't worry, it's not a joke. It's one of the upcoming events in this year's Spirit and Place Festival, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here to tell us more.
It really should be a joke.
Let's work on the punchline.
I think it'll be fun. It's going to be a really lively conversation, and one of those in part will be taking part is sociologist and author Matthew Desmond. He is the MacArthur genius, and his best-selling book on poverty and homelessness in the U.S. has helped earn him that distinction. So I called him on the phone to learn more about his upcoming visit to Indianapolis and about that award.
It's a grant of $625,000 with no strings attached that I'm going to use to help further my research on poverty in America.
And did you apply for it, or did they just, they've been following your work and selected you?
No, you don't apply for it. Somebody nominates you. You have no idea who that person is. And I think that they go and they gather more nominations, and then they make a decision. It's something you can't apply for.
It's a wonderful surprise, and you are going to use it well, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was a special day.
Now, the Spirit and Place theme this year is home. So first of all, I want to ask you what home means to you.
Well, I'm a guy that grew up in small town Arizona, and when I think of home, I think of my hometown, which is Winslow, Arizona, like in that Eagle song, and my actual home, which was on a little piece of land outside of Winslow, and so I guess I think about that, and I think about family, and I think about security. It's a powerful word, home. You know, in languages spoken all over the world, the word for home encompasses not just shelter, but warmth and family and community. The Egyptians had an ancient hieroglyph for home. It's the same symbol they used for the word mother. I think that's very telling.
And obviously, with your book and the research that you've done into poverty, home has a completely different meaning there, or it could.
I think that, you know, when you take a look at what's happening to families of moderate means today, you realize that the home is something that is quickly slipping out of their grasp. You know, we've reached a point in America where the majority of poor renting families are spending at least half of their income on housing costs, and one in four are spending over 70% of what they have just on rent and utilities. And under those conditions, you know, eviction has become something that's really commonplace, and it's completely transforming the lives of families and communities all across the country. And so what a home is, you know, stability and somewhere you can settle down and grow roots, that idea is becoming something that seems more like a dream or just a plain idea to millions of families below the poverty line today.
Does that also mean we have to have a new or a different definition of home? Is home more a sense of people and surroundings then, or does it have to be a solid, secure place?
I think that we have to recognize that the lack of affordable housing is really central to deepening inequality in America today. We can't fix poverty without fixing housing. And I do think it means recognizing the centrality of having a home to so many issues that we care about. You know, if we care about educational success, we want to give kids a shot at reaching their full potential. We have to give them a stable, affordable home. If we care about health disparities and decreasing rates of stress or anxiety or depression, things that we know are associated with housing insecurity and bad housing quality, we need to invest in better housing, better homes. And so I think that no matter what our issue is related to societal life, the home is going to be deeply implicated in that issue.
What is something that we, just as an average person, could do that could contribute and help to provide that sense of a home for everyone?
So one thing that I've done with proceeds from this book is start an organization called Just Shelter. And you and your listeners could go to a website called justshelter.org, and you could find out how to plug in at the national level or at the local level. So if you're in Indianapolis or Cincinnati or Pittsburgh, you can look on that website for organizations that are just putting in work trying to decrease family homelessness and fight evictions right in your own backyard.
You know, Desmond really has some good suggestions for people that want to make a difference when it comes to helping the homeless population in their communities. And you can hear more from him and several other panelists for free. It's all part of the Spirit in Place Festival. He's going to be here in Indianapolis on November the 13th. That's a Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Indiana Landmark Center.
What an inspiring person. And, you know, I love that Spirit in Place Festival has been around so long, and they're finally getting to the theme of home. What a beautiful theme. And so dozens, actually scores of events throughout our city at the intersection of spirituality, the arts, and culture. And if you can't find something at the Spirit in Place Festival to interest you, you're not looking hard enough.
There's a real cross-section of people and cultures involved this year, too, which every year it's different. I mean, they can't continue to do the same thing every year, which is the beauty of this event. But exactly. And so many of the events are free, too, for people, and family-oriented, all ages, that kind of thing.
You can plot your attack at spiritandplace.org. That's spirit, the word, and place.org. And it's actually very user-friendly. You can look at your schedule and figure out when you're free and when there's an event you want to go to. But you know what? That is not the only thing coming up. We have lots more events to tell you about on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
Well,
tell
continuing on with Spirit in Place, another thing that's very interesting, and since we're coming out of Vonnegut Fest and Veterans Day and all of that, the Sapphire Theater Company is putting on an interactive performance that's designed for the military, for their members of their families, and those especially suffering with PTSD. They're going to be doing this performance. It's called Rebuilding Home. Moral Injury to Soul Repair. And I have a feeling that, once again, this is something that could go for everybody, but they definitely want to invite military members, veterans, families, and friends to come together to help them foster healthy communication and to reconnect if they've served in the military in their home or they know someone who has. It takes place Thursday, November the 10th. There are two sessions from 1 to 2:30 in the afternoon and then again from 6 to 7:30 at night at the Athenaeum right downtown there on Michigan Street. It's free and walk-ins are welcome as well, too. And the Sapphire Theater Company, they group with a couple of other, the yoga community and the YMCA. They're a really good group, and that's going to be a very moving and worthwhile event to attend.
Fantastic. So for something completely different, imagine that it's the Kit Kat Club in Germany in 1929, and we're going to go in. We're going to leave our troubles outside the door, and the MC and Sally Bowles are going to lead us through some not rated G entertainment, PG, you might say, and all of the musicians are beautiful, and the girls are beautiful, and the audience is beautiful, but there's something really menacing on the horizon. That's the setup for, if you haven't figured it out yet, Cabaret, the multi-Tony Award-winning iconic book musical. And it's on stage now through November 20th at Actors Theater of Indiana. You can find more about that production and just go and leave your troubles outside the door. Election? What election? We're going to hear some music.
Classic music that so many different generations of people have seen it, too. And it's always fun to see how every different theater company interprets it or reinterprets
That's
it,
That's
the
too. Test of a well-written piece, exactly. That you can reinterpret it in many ways.
Boy, yeah. It truly is. All right, if we haven't offered anything that interests you, then here's what you do. You learn more about local arts events at the IndieArts.org guide. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's guide. It's at IndieArts.org/guide.
Or you can join us again next week for our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Hey, want to start an intense conversation? Bring up gun rights, even when it's not a hotly contested presidential election year. The artists in the Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art show Unloaded visualize the power of the gun as both icon and instrument in sculptures and in installations. I invited IMOCA's executive director Paula Katz and installation artist Tom Hubbard to tell me about the exhibit, which is on view at two Indianapolis venues through December. So, Paula, when did you first hear about this exhibition and say, this is us, we have to have this?
Yeah, actually, Suzanne Slavik sent a prospectus to me, and it looked like a great show. And, of course, it's always wonderful when you can actually see artwork in person. Coincidentally, I was also talking to Tom Hubbard about his Recoil project and a potential gun show. So this just seemed like a perfect happenstance that this would get presented to me. I happened to be going out to a conference in Pittsburgh, and so I actually had a chance to see the work in person, and Tom actually went out to see the show as well. So I obviously believe very firmly that art can be appreciated, seen online or other forms, but it's fantastic when you can see it in person.
Absolutely, so. Absolutely. Recoil? Tell us.
Yeah, I got interested a couple of years ago in the gun violence and the sort of never-ending stream of violence that I was seeing on the news.
Sure.
And my work isn't typically political, but I just felt the need to do something about this. And so my idea was to develop a piece of, to develop a work that could possibly start a conversation, the conversation that we had been promised about gun violence shortly after Sandy Hook that never seemed to materialize. So that was my goal.
Hmm. And you have a really interesting series. I was navigating around your website, looking at some of your work. You have a really interesting series about tools, and it struck me. Do you think of a gun as a tool, or what, if you had to categorize it, what
yeah.
is it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've talked a lot with my family about this, and my mother grew up on a farm, and she said, you know, look, guns were always around, but they were there for various reasons, hunting or protection or what have you. And I said, yeah, a gun, you know, a gun in that case is a tool. A gun in the hands of a trained military officer or policeman is a tool. But I'm not sure everyone considers them to be so.
Mm-hmm. Your work, you like photography, you like ceramics. How would you describe how you evolved into the artistic vocabulary that you have?
Well, I'm trained as a graphic designer. My background is in graphic design. And so I don't do exclusively design projects anymore, but there's still a lot of design in my work. And whether I'm doing an installation of public art or doing a ceramic installation, as in this case, that design background still comes through. And from the standpoint that I really believe that the best solution and the final form that the piece takes really comes from the problem. I don't come up with a preconceived idea and say this is what it's going to be. I kind of let the project drive that.
When you're figuring out what the problem is, how do you frame that?
I have this kind of process of immersion, you know, and so if it's a site-specific work, then I go to the site and I research it and I just hang out there and kind of see how it speaks to me and try to get a sense of what feels appropriate and what doesn't. And, you know, in this case, I did a lot of reading and a lot of scouring of the internet and you know, of talking to, you know, to friends and family, you know, about this issue. And I realized that when I started making these studies that, you know, there's an idea about what you're doing. Oh, you're making guns. You know, you must be this, feel this way or that way. But when I started putting the guns in people's hands, I realized that's where the discussion started. Because what I'm doing is stamping text that are opposite sides of the gun debate into the gun. And I think that physical act of stamping and actually having someone interact with that, you know, gets them to think about things slightly differently.
Paula, why was he the right artist to commission for this installation piece?
Yeah, well, actually, I've worked with Tom before, so he's a wonderful person to work with and very reliable, makes very strong work, very thoughtful work. We had worked together on a project where we brought together artists who were Vietnam vets, as well as Tom, whose father was killed in Vietnam, mm-hmm. who he never met, and he worked for several years on a Vietnam project around that. So he doesn't pick easy topics to focus on. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Tom really came to me. We've always been, I think, on each other's radar and talked about working together again. And like I said, he kind of put together this proposal and it just meshed really well with timing in terms of getting Suzanne's proposal as well for hosting Unloaded here in Indianapolis.
You have children.
Yes, I have two boys.
How old are your kids?
20 and 16.
And were they part of your brain trust when you started thinking about this project?
Oh, absolutely. I mean they were part of it. I mean when we lived in Ohio, there was a school shooting at Chardon, Ohio a few years ago that was just a few miles down the road from where we lived and was actually a school that we had looked at putting our boys into when we moved into the area, and that really hit close to home. You know, beyond that, they've always been involved and in and out of the studio with me. And in fact, I had a really great summer with my boys because I had both of them helping me on this project in the studio. So
In addition to this installation, when people are hearing our conversation, this will be over, but I know you're preparing to actually go to a gun show with some of these pieces. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Through IMOCA and the Visual Artist Network, I had an opportunity to do a small residency or a project involving the community. And so Paula had asked if I had any ideas around that. And I said, yeah, actually I do. I'd love to take these to a gun show and really start that conversation. And so the end of October, we'll be at the State Fairgrounds, and I'll have a vendor table set up there during the gun show for 3 days.
Can you give us an example of some of the texts on both sides of both the physical piece and the argument?
Yeah. I mean, I really tried to be neutral, but at the same time, by being neutral, I realized that there really wasn't going to be much of a conversation starter there. So there's two or three places where I intentionally paired things to kind of stir the pot a little bit and to get a reaction. So the installation starts off with simply the words of the Second Amendment, and that's followed by an evangelical reverend in Washington, D.C., who basically makes the claim that when we put the Second Amendment above the Second Commandment, we have to be careful that we don't violate the Second Commandment. And that's paired with another quote that says when gun restrictions are like banning the Bible, you know. So this touches on this very you know, not only controversial but complicated issue that covers everything from religious and personal freedoms to mental illness to domestic violence to current events, you know, such as the shooting of the young boy Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Ohio. So, like I say, there's a couple of places where I intentionally wanted to stir the pot a little bit in order to get that conversation started.
IMOCA's executive director Paula Katz and installation artist Tom Hubbard. Unloaded is on view at IMOCA at the Murphy through November 19th and at IMOCA at Cityway through December 31st. You can see Tom's IMOCA commissioned installation of ceramic guns imprinted with names of events and quotes from speeches and writings about guns in contemporary American culture at both venues. Up next, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long visits with Sirius Black.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and I'm here with the Indianapolis MC, musician, artist, Sirius Black. He has a new album coming out titled Nightcrawler. Sirius, we're going to go through like five songs here with you and your Ghost Gun Summer Collective colleagues. These are guys you make music with and tour with. And, yeah, tell us about Ghost Gun.
Ghost Gun is basically just me and all the homies, Oreo Jones, Gray Granite, Freddie Buns, John Stamps, and myself. Ghost Gun Summer started through blending all three of our collectives, Ghost Town, Heavy Gun, and Rad Summer. Ghost Gun Summer is what we tour under, and so it's just one big, you know, happy family.
Yeah. Well, let's start with a song off your new record, Nightcrawler. Let's play Ride Around, which is kind of the first single. Tell us about Ride Around.
Ride Around is an awesome song. You should listen to it while you're riding around with your friends.
And how about Grizz, another member of the Ghost Gun Collective?
Yeah, man, Grizz, that's my best bear friend. He's been in music out here for over a decade. He started in the hardcore community. He was in an awesome band called Opponents, another awesome band called Composer Meets Corpse back in the way back in the day. And he started doing hip-hop music, and now he's the best at that. And he just dropped a project with Bones of Ghosts, who produced all of my new album Nightcrawler. Their project is called Bare Bones.
No pain when I flow, we go bathe in the smoke, got a few barrels. holes in my carpet, entertaining the ghost, but I know that I'm playing a song alone in this apartment. I ain't never really taking it slow, got the heart like a landfill, lungs like a tar pit.
And John Stamps, who I had on the show with his album release earlier this summer.
Stamps is one of my closest homies. He's mad talented, and him and K-Nags produced all of his latest album called Green Eggs and Yam. If you have not heard Green Eggs and Yam, please go listen to it. It's a phenomenal record. And this song is called Hour Ago. This is one of my favorite tracks on that record.
You ain't body, body no more. How we came about, I don't know. How you throwing shade in my shoes? Cause you ain't getting love like before. I think I care where gonna go. My Phoenix kicking back in.
DMA, who's kind of loosely affiliated, right, with the Ghost Gun Summer Collective, David Moose Adamson, very talented musician who people may know from Jukebox and now does electronic music, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what is it about his production and his whole like musical vision that appeals to you?
Well, I listened to Jukebox in high school. Me and my guitarist, Jonah, he put me onto Jukebox when we were in high school, and that was kind of my introduction to him as an artist. But I didn't even make the connection that Moose was in Jukebox until like a couple of years ago, so that like blew my mind, because he was already one of my favorite artists. OJ put me on to Feel Free, and I love that record so much. And he always finds a way to reinvent himself, you know, when he puts out a new album. So I think that's just super awesome. I feel like that's something that I always try to aim to do as well. So yeah, mad respect and love for DMA.
Yeah, and let's end this segment with Oreo Jones, who's the man of Indianapolis hip hop, right?
Yeah, man, he's the OG, man. You know, started Trees, and he just put out an amazing record called Cash for Gold, which is one of my favorite records of all time.
And Sirius Black, thank you for sharing these five songs with us. Your new album is called Nightcrawler. How can people get a copy of this record?
You can get a copy of Nightcrawler at your local record store, Luna, Indie CD, and Vinyl.
Thanks, man.
Kyle Long with Sirius Black. Here, Kyle, is a cultural manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for spending some time with The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today's contributors included Pete Brown, Chantal Incandola, and Jill Dittmeyer. You can hear our program twice each week on 90.1 FM, Saturday mornings at 7 and Thursday evenings at 8. And if you hear something you like and want to share, go to WFYI.org for our podcast. Tune in next week when we'll hear about a 40th anniversary tribute to the band's The Last Waltz, especially apropos in this year when Bob Dylan's been awarded the Nobel Prize. We'll chat with a former Indiana Poet Laureate about his new prose book and, take your allergy medicine, have a sneak peek of the upcoming Internet Cat Video Festival. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.